Well, thank you for coming to the last session of Summer School at the Modern. We've had an introduction to abstract expressionism, pop art, minimalism, and today we wrap up the course with an introduction to conceptual art with Dr. Michael Corris. Next month, we resume our Sundays with the Modern program, and we'll kick that off on October 2nd with artist Michelle Mackey giving us a tour of Richard Diebenkorn, our new special exhibition that opens later this month. But today, it's my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Michael Corris. He's an artist and a writer and currently serves as chair of the Division of Art at the Meadows School of the Arts at SMU. And during the early 1970s, he worked with the conceptual art group Art and Language in New York. With Mel Ramsden, Joseph Kosuth, Sarah Charlesworth, and others, he was a founding editor of The Fox, an artist-run journal that addressed itself to the political and social dimensions of contemporary artistic practice. And following the demise of Art and Language in New York, he continued his practice, dividing his energies between artist books that were inspired by typographic design and lecturing and writing on contemporary art and art theory. Both as a member of Art and Language and as an individual artist, his work's been exhibited internationally, and he's included in the permanent collections of museums like MoMA and the Whitney in New York, the Victoria and Albert Museum in London, and the Getty out in LA. His art criticism has been very widely published in forums like Art Monthly, Art Forum, Flash Art, Art History, and Mute, and has been included in several published collections like Conceptual Art, A Critical Anthology, and Art Has No History. His most recent publications include Conceptual Art, Theory, Myth, and Practice, Ad Reinhardt, A Mute Reader, and most recently from 2010, Art, Word, and Image, 2,000 Years of Visual Textual Interaction with fellow writers John Dixon Hunt and David Lomas. Please join me in welcoming Michael Corris.
Thanks very much. I'm going to start in this kind of classical situation, standing in front of a painting and talking about it. New to the audience. Okay. A couple of things about terminology. I'm going to use the expression the beholder or the spectator. That kind of refers to anybody who puts themselves in that position in front of a work of art or considers a work of art. I'll also talk about the reader, which is a much more normal kind of category, which involves just basically the reading of text and the reflection on text. And I'm going to talk about the confusion of the two that conceptual art brought into being and was so fruitful and important for it. But first, the question that I want to ask, and it'll be a rhetorical question. Sometimes I'll ask questions and answer them for you, but other times just want you to kind of consider what's being presented. This is an Ellsworth Kelly from fairly early in his career. Ellsworth Kelly was a GI, World War II. Thanks to the GI Bill, he got to go to Paris in the early 1950s and spent several years there. Came back to New York around 53, 54. So while he was in Paris, he kind of was outside of the great tsunami of abstract expressionism that was really coming to a head and would dominate really the 1950s in the New York art world. There were similar kind of movements happening in France, in Spain, in Germany, and Italy at the time under the name Tachisme and so on, but they were not really well regarded by American critics and were pretty much out of the picture against the great giants of abstract expressionism like de Kooning and Pollock, Lee Krasner, Mark Rothko, and so on and so forth. So Kelly, being an artist, being a painter, is sort of off to the side of that, which gives him a tremendous advantage. Being on the margins of that, he's got a little bit of space to think for himself and to be outside of the fray. Doesn't have to necessarily engage with the conversation about art as either action painting or some kind of abstract representation of the existential crisis that post-war America was going through, that people were feeling in the shadow of the atomic bomb, the beginning of the Cold War, and the absolute devastation that occurred in Europe from 1945 from 1939 to 1945. His work is very simple in terms of color and form. And the question to ask is, what makes it a work of art? Ask this question and you start to go through an inventory in your own mind about those characteristics and qualities that you associate with arthood, art making. Okay, pretty much now, our expectations are set by the fact that everything we see within the museum, we already expect to be art, to have been somehow nominated for that category, and of sufficient quality to be placed in that canon of objects that are not part of everyday life, but they're somehow elevated, and they're here for our contemplation, for our perusal, for our reflection, in a very different kind of setting, a setting absolutely removed from the commerce and intercourse of everyday life. So here you have an artist who's dealing with very simple form, almost pure colors, colors that can be just taken out of a can or a tube. And the question is, why is it art? There's not a lot of technical proficiency that's required. It's got the form and the look of a craftsman-like object, a craftsperson-like object. It's got a form involved with it, the red curving form, which looks like the top half of an interrogation mark, question mark. So it's already familiar in a sense. It has map-like qualities because there's no sense of tonality, shading, or any kind of three-dimensional illusion. It's like a chart or a diagram. And yet we're still kind of asking, why is it art? It might be a very interesting kind of design, but what sort of deeper import does it have? Okay. It's an important question to ask. I mean, if you've gone through the minimalism summer course, because we're going to recapitulate minimalism here to give it a different kind of relationship to the present and to the historical past, which was conceptual art. If you go through that course, you're probably familiar with the idea of reduction, of this tendency in art of the 20th century that was really first identified by a very interesting philosopher and art critic, Richard Vollheim, who talked about minimalism and actually coined that phrase way back, I think, in 1964, if not earlier, probably it's 1962. He talks about this tendency of all of art of the 20th century to kind of reduce itself, to simplify itself. And he engages with a number of different categories in sculpture and in painting. And at the end of his article, he's discussing work by people like Ad Reinhardt, whose painting might look like just a black square if you just walk by it. And he's also kind of engaging in a general way with an artist like Ellsworth Kelly. You can say that Kelly was interested in a kind of a reduction, in going back to basics, not necessarily a purification of painting, but a new beginning, responding to that which went before him. And that's a pretty important part, because this whole sweep of work we're going to look at, the entire period from the mid to late 1950s all the way up to like about 1972, even though works that we see are going to post-date that, but the people who made these works emerged and developed their position as artists within that time frame. We're going to see something that really signifies the last position in modern and contemporary art that was interested in the idea of development and evolution of art. So beyond that, the notion that an art develops with reference to the past is not necessarily held in the same regard. The idea of progress in art, which was the guiding impetus of critical writing, and even, as we're going to see, I think the making of art by artists from the 50s, 60s, and up till the early 70s, has dissipated and results in a field where pretty much anything goes, and any media, any approach, any subject, any attitude towards art is going to be considered on par with every other. It's a condition that we call pluralism, and it's associated with the end or wrapping up of this modernist idea of progress in art. We saw the same kind of idea in architecture throughout the 20s and 30s with the emergence of the modernist architect movement. But then around the 1970s and 80s, we see something that we call postmodernism, which already kind of confounds us with a very different reality about art. So one of the motivations that I want to ascribe to Kelly, one of the intentions he had as an artist, is to engage in that conversation of progressing art and how to do that. And that's very different from a very romantic notion of art about the artist as the individual, effectively isolated, looking for a subject that has an emotional resonance to them. That's the kind of idea about art that comes in with all of the students that I deal with in the first year. And my colleagues who are here who are educators would probably recognize that. And still persists in many ways. It becomes rather exaggerated in some forms. So for example, a contemporary artist like Tracy Emin, who happens to be British, or even Kiki Smith, who is an American. Both women, both working across many media, both focusing on their life, their existence, their situation in the world as the subject matter for that. Something that could be construed as a romantic position, though in the hands of both of those artists, I think it's slightly different. But the overriding cliche is the romantic artist in the studio, isolated from the world, looking for the subject, filled with passion, filled with confusion, and absolutely tragic in every aspect of their life. Kelly is cool in the sense of there is no incident, no sense of incidents on the canvas. It could have been done by a machine. It could have been spray painted. There's really no indication that this was a work done by hand, but there's plenty to tell us that it is a work that was done by an intelligence, a mind. So there is something behind it. So you ask yourself, why is it that artists want to jettison that whole tradition of working from the inside out, so to speak, from the romantic model, and start to make works like this? Does this work sit well with you? Does it confuse you? It is, after all, still a painting. And as radical as these ideas may seem, they're still done within the very established frame of the painting. Even a Cubist painting, so from Picasso and Braque from 1907 to 1912, as strange as those looked, they were still operating within the frame of painting. Cubist collage, the work, again, that Picasso and Braque would be doing, but also Schwitters and other people, that was an interesting departure, because that was saying, this is not a painting, and the challenge is, how do you reconcile this material with the material of art, whether it be painting or sculpture? And then, of course, we have the example of Marcel Duchamp, who, with his fantastic life of dandyism and brilliance, just suggests that the artist's choice is what matters above all. Not making an object, not what the object could mean because of its subject matter, not what it pictures, but simply the act of choosing it was going to be the core intentionality of making art and to nominate art. So we have all this kind of flowing around, and it really doesn't start to become this idea of evolution through this kind of questioning of the boundaries and the conventions of art doesn't really start to gain steam until the late 50s and the early 1960s, as more and more people are getting sort of disabused of the idea of the romantic. They've seen a lot of abstract expressionism. There's simply this weight of the past building up that people are looking for a way out. And I would suggest that the first thing that artists thought about in that period was how to be different, how to be unique, and to create something that didn't exist before. This idea of originality is also something that's received a beating over the past couple of decades. And it actually starts with a French philosopher named Roland Barthes, who starts talking about this idea of the death of the author. And he's talking about this in terms of literature and the act of reading. And he's saying whenever anybody reads a text, they rewrite a text effectively through interpretation. That text is no longer the property of the authors. Another interesting artist, Alan Capro, maybe you've heard of him, who invented the form called happenings, which came out of performance and lots of things that were going on with people like John Cage, Jasper Johns, Rauschenberg, and so on at the end of the 1950s. He said the audience has to be killed. Fortunately, he didn't mean that literally. But what he meant was, I'm no longer interested in being an artist where the relationship to what I do and those who view it is one of the spectator relationship, where you are the beholder. So the beholder has to become an actor. And to just kind of jump ahead a little bit, conceptual art is really about the beholder becoming a collaborator and a co-worker in the making of the work of art. And that kind of collaboration can take the form of either simply reading, interpreting, and completing something imaginatively or through actions, through a script, or simply by reading and considering it, or actually to engaging as a collaborator with artists. In other words, removing yourself from the position of the outsider and bringing yourself in to the position of the maker. That was very important because that was about leveling cultural hierarchies. Okay, so right now here we've got this interesting position, and the work of Ellsworth Kelly, later work, this work being from the 1980s, it follows on from quite a lot of work that he had developed in between this point and that point in time, where what he's looking at is trying to take color and form and create something that has nothing to do with composition or pictorialism, but simply this pure sensation, this idea of color form. We just consider it as one term. A lot of his inspiration comes from glimpses of the environment that have elements of color to them. Famously, when he was in Paris, he was getting inspiration going to cathedrals, presumably to admire the paintings, the altarpieces, and the stained glass window, but all that he could really focus on were some architectural features of the mullions of window frames. And he thought, that's an interesting subject, so we could just have this very rectilinear pattern. It's about this kind of experience, direct experience of an environment, visual, translated into something that wasn't pictorial, but tries to evoke that sense of, I guess, wholeness or completeness of form and color. When we walk through the world, we don't usually consider separating things into little bits. We take it in as a whole, as a gestalt, as they say. And so the point for Ellsworth Kelly was, can painting be that kind of gestalt? And that was a considerably important step from, say, abstract expressionism, where painting might be the record of a particular struggle. Famously, the abstract expressionists didn't do preparatory sketches. They just attacked the canvas and hardly knew when the painting was finished. The big issue for the artists then, they talked about amongst themselves over coffee in all the cafeterias in New York, was when is a painting finished? Pollock had some ideas about that. He would get involved in a process. that could last half an hour or 2 hours. That finished, he hung what he did up on the wall, looked at it, considered it, then took it down again and worked on it again. Okay, so there was something going on that had to do with improvisation and spontaneity. For Ellsworth Kelly, there's no improvisation. There's a very well-designed, well-considered format. And there's no spontaneity. Here's the job, and then I have to go ahead and realize it. And the art part, if you will, or at least the interest, I mean, what keeps somebody going in that, is really what happens from the encounter with the world and the formulation of this kind of color form or this particular icon that represents it. The actual making of the work does not have the same kind of pull. If any of you were at the Tony Cragg lecture yesterday at the Nasher, hands up if you went to see Tony Cragg. Oh, okay, one. Anyway, Tony Cragg made a big deal about talking about himself as a materialist sculptor and made some real, you know, very direct attacks on what he called conceptualism. Because for him, the work of the artist was to engage with material and to discover what could be done through that engagement. The notion of a preconceived idea simply being realized in a more or less graphic form with two-dimensionally through paint or three-dimensionally with other materials did not appeal to him, and for his money that was of no use at all in terms of art. But here we have this other kind of tradition that's coming forward. So I think now we're going to move over to this little gallery on the side to have a look at Carl Andre. Yeah. Okay. That's... Okay. So this, let's see. Could actually walk on it, can't you? He wanted to walk on it. Okay. Just,
I'm trying to get opposite of
you. Oh, are you? I'm just walking. The reason I'm perambulating is because that's what you're supposed to do with minimal art. You're supposed to walk around and consider it from a lot of different vantage points, see how it changes. This is a work of Carl Andre's called Slit from 1981. The titles of his pieces are quite descriptive. That's another aspect of the work that we're leading up to. Until we get to a point where you start getting things called untitled for a very good reason, because the artist wants you to focus on the thing in itself. I always talk about minimal art in terms of the film The Deer Hunter. Hands up if you've seen that film. Robert De Niro, Christopher Walken. Okay. In one of the sequences, this group of guys in rural Pennsylvania are going out hunting, and they've got their rifles. One of the characters didn't bring the right shoes and really gets beat up for that. But Robert De Niro takes out a .30-07 shell, and he says famously, "This is this." Okay, so there's a lot to read into that. There's the existential dimension, you know, that this could spell the end of everything. There's nothing greater than this. This is the icy finality of death, et cetera, et cetera. But the thing I like about it is pointing out, bringing attention to the thing in itself, which is what minimal art does. So it goes beyond this idea, even that Ellsworth Kelly was interested in, which was somehow creating an analog to a particular kind of visual experience. Not a picture, but a simulation. Here, there's nothing pictorial at all that you could attach to this without starting to get into a lot of trouble and trampling on a lot of the intentions of the artist. Having said that, I must say that even Carl Andre was kind of pressured into providing some kind of metaphor for this kind of work. He started doing these squares of industrial milled metals, which he would arrange sometimes with nothing but steel, sometimes zinc and copper together, different kinds of metals which had different patinas, different finishes, different colorations, but all coming off the assembly line. That was the important thing. His job was simply to arrange them, and he arranged them in, for him, the most neutral configuration he could think of, which would be a grid. Sometimes they took the form of these long paths, which actually invites you to walk around them and alongside them. Other times he used some very interesting materials. When he first started out, he used bales of hay in a row. He used these beautiful pink styrofoam battens that were lined up in a piece that he called Reef, which of course is an absolute reference to a coral reef and that kind of naturalism. I think when he refers to the naturalism, he's kind of making an ironic gesture. For him, what's flat is landscape. Okay, and he often talked about these kinds of works, which began in the mid to late 1960s, as the stillness on the surface of a lake when you're in a canoe in the middle of a lake, that sort of sense. There was always a little bit hippie about Carl Andre. If you've seen him, the early photographs of him, long beard, he looks a little like Gustave Courbet in overalls. He exuded this workerist pretension because it was all about the absolute veracity of the material. It was not about making a poetic statement as much as gathering things and allowing them to speak through the materiality. So we've already gone pretty far from representation, as far as you might have thought Ellsworth Kelly went from creating a link between an image or an object and a reference in the world. This goes beyond that. It certainly goes beyond the conventions of art, because it's not really a picture of anything. And if it's referring strongly to anything at all, it's referring to an entire other convention and tradition of making. Again, this industrial kind of approach. So we have this standardization, and like many artists of his generation, he's working in series. So he's doing variations on this theme. What that does is allows the artist to select a parameter and work within it until it's exhausted. Saul LeWitt is another person who did that. That removes something very important for the artist to do, which is a motivation of making a particular form. These forms were often called unmotivated by critics at the time, and that was considered to be something to strive for by these artists. How to make something that looked like it had no idea of what it should look like behind it, but something that related to the very materiality. So this kind of truth to materials takes on a very interesting spin for this kind of work. We often hear sculptors talk about this notion of truth to materials, especially you're working in wood or stone. You want to bring out the woodness or the stoneness of it, whatever that might be. Here, it's just the ordinariness, the mundanity of it, just the actual physical nature of it. It occupies a kind of a space, but it's like a surface. Okay. But the main thing is, Andre didn't mind if you walked over these kinds of pieces. The Fort Worth Modern might have a different point of view, but that's good, because they were meant to be part of the architecture. So here's another interesting shift. The painting, okay, that occupies a space on the wall, And a lot of artists who were painters were interested in integrating their work with architecture. I mean, we have the great tradition of commissioned work for churches that are sited in particular places. So that was very familiar. But you know that there's something up there that's special and different. This kind of likes to sort of fade into its surroundings, but in so doing, creating a kind of a impediment, as minor as it is, that might make you a little bit more aware of the surroundings in a particular way. That's why your movement around works of minimal art is very important. They're not works that can be appreciated frontally. Your job is actually to get in motion. So you're already being told as a spectator or a beholder to do something, to perform a particular act. Depending on the kind of work we're looking at, you will have a sense almost of there being another figure in the room. So there's this idea which we call embodiment, where all of a sudden your relationship to space and an object has as much to do with the physicality of your body, the scale, the mobility, the various points of view that you could take in, as the thing that you're looking at, the thing in itself. So we get this very odd sense in minimal art of installations that are surrogates for figures. For example, Robert Morris, who would do these fabulous plywood constructions that would cantilever from the wall, or would just be huge blockades, cubes, right in the middle, blocking the most obvious path through the space. Those kinds of things have a debt to performance, and in fact, Robert Morris's early work, the 60s, was very interested to be a kind of token of a past performance. He would often use these as props, working with other artists like Carolee Schneemann. He even put together an exhibition in London in 1971 that consisted of lots of plywood constructions that people were encouraged to go on and use as if they were a playground set up. They closed that after a week because they were afraid of the safety hazard of it. But there are some installation photographs of people using these particular sculptures. So you couldn't really call them sculptures anymore. What were they? And I think it remained for the artist Donald Judd to sort of make the critical and theoretical leap as early, I think, as 1964, when he coined another very interesting term, specific object, something between painting and sculpture. Again, this is probably recapitulating what you've heard about minimal art, but it has to do with setting us up for conceptual art. I only wish there were more examples of conceptual art to see, but I actually brought one of my own from 1969. This is the first issue of the Art Language Journal, and it contains an introduction by the editors, who are Terry Atkinson, David Bainbridge, Michael Baldwin, and Harold Harrell, who are all from the Midlands in Britain. It also has Saul LeWitt's Sentences on Conceptual Art, Dan Graham's Poem Schema, Larry Wiener's Statements, and some other notes and commentary by the founding editors. This itself is not necessarily a work of art. But the question that it raises is, what if you considered an essay on art theory to have the same status as the work that it was addressing? What would that mean to the boundaries of art and the ability of art to evolve? The short answer is that everything that we take in when we behold art, when we look at art, we think about art, involves a language form. It's not simply a purely visual experience. And this led people to wonder about the relationship between all of this art language, which was always considered supplemental and of a different order than the work itself, to the actual making of the work. The contemporary understanding of conceptual art is a very reduced and misleading one. basically can be summarized as, it's not the work that counts, it's the idea behind it. Well, you show me something that doesn't have an idea behind it, and I'll show you something that is certainly not made by a human being, possibly not even by a mammal, and even not possibly an insect, but we do know that bees have some sort of imprinting that allows them to build these very elaborate hives and so on and so forth. So this idea that ideas are what conceptual art is about is nonsense. But it's a big stick that people use to beat over the head of those people who are a little skeptical about the romantic idea of art or about art that is absolutely only about form or that says the only way you can make art of quality is by engaging with materials. You really can't presuppose what the outcome is. You just have to do it. And if you're a good artist, you'll find that. You'll be able to repeat that to convince people that it wasn't just a mistake or an accident. And that's how it goes. Very little concern with the framework that holds it all together. And that framework can be just as simple as your relationship to the object itself as spectator, or as broad as the entire culture of art in the society, which includes the museums, the art magazines, the art critics, the art historians, the artists, the art schools, the art supply places, all of this stuff. What counts as a resource for making art for us today? So at one point in the history of the world, all that became rather confusing and uncertain. And that happened during the mid to late 1960s. And out of that uncertainty came conceptual art, which for my money is good if it isn't sure of itself, even to this day. But I'm afraid there's very little in our world that encourages that kind of constant exploration. This is a work of Lawrence Wiener's, or Larry, as we call him, from 1990. The interesting thing about Larry's work is you can't really date it by what it looks like, hardly. There are some particular strategies that he's introduced into his work recently, more extensive and elaborate displays of text, sometimes the use of neon, sometimes things that are meant to be read in a different order than just the linear order, and so on. But really, for a very long time, since 1968, he's been working with this idea of expressing an action or describing a situation of matter. Now, I wish Larry was at Tony Cragg's talk yesterday, because Larry also considers himself a materialist. But he considers himself a materialist in a very different sense. He said, the problem for me is in the normal world of art, you have a lump of lead and a lump of gold, and the gold is more valuable and considered of greater aesthetic value and so on. He said, what if we consider a system where the lump of gold and the lump of lead were the same, simply because they were lumps of matter. They were particular kinds of things. And from that came this idea that it was not what you made from the matter, how you formed the matter to create an object, but simply the manipulation of the matter that was at issue. So in a piece he wrote in 1968 called Statements, which are really just a series of a dozen statements, and he divided them into general and specific statements. I'll read a couple of them. A field cratered by structured simultaneous TNT explosions. One sheet of plywood secured to the floor or wall. A removal to the lathing or support wall of plaster or wallboard from the wall. And one of my favorites, one standard dye marker thrown into the sea. These general statements were plans for work. And some of them were actually realized by Larry in various museum shows and for individual collectors. So for example, for one collector, he removed a section of the asphalt driveway in front of their home. For a show, a very important show called When Attitudes Become Form, that originated in Bern, Switzerland, it was curated by Harald Zeman, he removed a 12-inch by 12-inch panel from the wall down to the lathe and plaster support, and so on. At a certain point, he realized that he didn't actually need to make these things. He just needed to specify the action. And so he then came up with this formulation. The collector buys the work, the collector owns the work, the collector can actually make the work, the artist need not make the work. So there was a situation where the collector all of a sudden was not just the person who purchased something and had it in a repository of sorts, their collection, but actually had to make the work from the instructions. And what was exchanged was not a piece, but just a sort of certificate of authenticity with the statement of the action to be performed and then Larry Wiener's signature and maybe, as we like to do then, one of those stamps that you imprint paper with, you know, a die-cut stamp. So that made it, that was it. And the piece could obviously be constructed and reconstructed at any location because effectively the collector purchased a franchise to make that work, no matter where they were. So that was the beginning of Larry kind of making the move out of performing actions and being a performance-based artist into being more of a conceptual artist in the sense of creating the conditions so that people could co-author the work. He's since kind of gone on with this particular kind of format or strategy where the kind of working of matter in a broad sense somehow refers to the situation in which the work itself, the text, is cited. So one lump, two lumps, three lumps, four. This was in the cafe at one point, right? Where it made some sort of parodic sense, I'm sure, talking about lumps of sugar. But it could also refer, in a rather satirical way, to the very collection in which we're situated. So we no longer think of these objects of art in as particular pictures of anything or as embodying something other than the material that they're made of, and they're somehow reduced to lumps. Larry liked this idea because he believed in democracy. He believes in democracy. And he's thinking the one anti-democratic thing that was always confronting him as an artist is his status as an artist versus the status of the beholder or the spectator. Okay. A lot of conceptual art had that overview and more or less struggled to put that into a kind of an institutional form, to give it a life that could continue. A lot of groups consisted of people working together for a time as a collective, so at least they had a sense of a community there. A lot of groups went out into the community and worked with people to develop strategies for art making. That sort of continues today. You've got a lot of people who are working outside of the institutions. But the key question to ask when you look at that kind of work is not, is it art? Because already the frame is wide enough to encompass anything, so that question becomes rather less important. But what is the relationship of the people who are instigating that project and the people that are somehow considered to be the subject of the project or the potential audience? We all have, as artists and writers, a notion of an audience in mind before we set out to do something. Even as if Walheim said, the initial audience of the artist is him or herself. When you're making a work and you're looking at it, you actually put yourself in the position of the spectator. But everybody has a kind of presupposition of who they're engaging with. It's only when things get circulated in the wider culture and we start to talk about art with a capital A, do we really need to discuss things like the universal qualities of art. And that, again, to kind of get back to Tony Cragg, because it really made an impression on me what he was saying, because I really felt he was a different kind of artist. He's sort of thinking that there is this tremendous, deep tradition, as he put it, every human being has a relationship to material, and the whole history of civilization has been our relationship to material, changing it, changing nature, building, making things out of it. So there you have a fantastic anthropological basis for art that is almost incontestable. How could you say anything against that? And yet, with conceptual art, you get this idea that maybe there is no convention, no matter how deeply held, no matter how much it's linked to the biology and society, that is not open for question about art. And that's sort of where conceptual art wanted to go. And in this particular issue of the journal, you've got that question being churned over and over in many different ways, and as artists start to think about their work like that, they realize that they need some other resources, intellectual resources, to deal with this. And so they start reaching outside of art, art history, to things like philosophy of science, philosophy of language, systems theory, cybernetics, anything that helps them figure out how to organize the world in a less than certain way. As I was talking earlier to this gentleman, the idea of conceptual art being a meta-art, being something that was reflecting on the condition of art, basically, was very, very much an idea held by people like Joseph Kosuth. And even Daniel Buren, who has predates conceptual art and is not necessarily associated with that and even has been anti-conceptual art, but certainly this notion of looking at something from another level and trying to develop a practice around that. We used to say, people would ask us, why do you put a text on the wall when you could just publish it in a pamphlet? It's so much easier to read. Well, turning the spectator into a reader changes the entire orientation that you have to the work. And it also does another very important thing, which it challenges the then dominant idea of quality in art as being something that was immediately apprehensible by vision. This critic, Clement Greenberg, and then one of his acolytes, Michael Fried, developed this idea, which was very powerful in the late 50s and right through the 1960s, that art was only about the visual experience and that that experience had to be immediate. That if there was anything in the work of art that led you away from that, then that was a poor piece of art. Michael Fried very famously criticized minimal art in an essay called Art and Objecthood, where he said the problem with minimal art is that it was theatrical. It was putting us in the position of an audience to a stage setting. In other words, it was bringing back into art that very thing that people, these critics, longed to eliminate from art and that they thought the abstract expressionists eliminated from art. And that is the notion of narrative, the idea of a picture or an image telling a story being able to be rolled out in a literary form, so therefore not purely visual. That was the business of literature, to create narratives, of film. Film, after all, was image and story together, and it was the most impure medium that Clement Greenberg and Michael Fried could think of. But this kind of bringing narrative back through the back door was very problematic for Michael Fried. And to this day, people refer to that essay and to that sense of that very good description by an opponent of minimal art as theatrical. And they wear that as a badge of pride, because we have much more theatrical art that has been produced. Consider the work of Joseph Beuys, for example, and Paul McCartney, all these people coming out of it. Now, it's, I guess, that piece there, Donald Judd, which is, it's nice to have it framed a little bit offside, just to end with this. Judd made the tremendous breakthrough that really looked very hard at somebody like Kelly. Judd starts out as a painter, as you know, and tries to do these wacky three-dimensional works, like a piece of plywood painted with cadmium red right out of the can, and a pipe going through it painted blue. And these were very awkward-looking pieces. And he decided that there was no way really to do with in painting what he wanted to do with color. The unity of the form and the color and the situation creates something very different, even extremely different from Carl André's wood construction. Then you get to conceptual art, and it's sort of more or less black and white for like 7 years. Lawrence was the only one who was starting to use this red and black sort of more graphic stuff, but he doesn't really go beyond that. He doesn't really go beyond that. And just to kind of wrap it up, the thing we used to say when asked again, which I brought up a few minutes ago, why do you put a text on the wall rather than have it in a publication where it's easier to read? And the answer is because every text on the wall is one less place for a painting to be cited. Okay, thank you.